Hello and welcome to Radio Free Nintendo. It is February 4th, 2021, and this is episode 708. I am James Jones. I am joined today by Mr. Greg Leahy.
Ahoy, ahoy, everyone.
Mr. John Lindemann.
It's great to be here, James.
And Mr. Guillaume Vaillette.
Hello, hello.
Punchy introductions are the way to get people to listen to your podcast. And so we are going to start right out of the gate with some new business. And Guillaume, I'm going to ask you to start us off, please.
Sure. I played Even the Ocean, which is the second game by the same team that made Anodyne, a game that I talked about in this podcast and I really loved. That was kind of Link's Awakening-esque, I believe I described it as, because it was definitely a Link's Awakening-esque game. But Even the Ocean is their second game, and it's a 2D platformer. And I don't know, not going to go over like Anodyne again, but it was a game that was clever. Like, it was doing things to surprise you.
Yeah, clever's the word you want.
Yeah, and it was, kind of playing with your expectations a lot. So going into this game, my expectations were set by having played Anodyne. And what I discovered pretty quickly is that it was not, not that this game is not clever, but it does not try to be clever. Like, it does not try to fool you or to thwart your expectations, at least in terms of gameplay. So this is a 2D platformer. There's no enemies. There's nothing that you can kill. There's obstacles, and there are enemies only insofar as they will rush into you and damage you or whatever it is. But it is fairly straightforward, is what I'm saying, and it is mostly purely platforming and puzzles. So in this game, you don't have exactly lives or life meter. Instead, what you have is this gauge that goes from it's binary. There's light and dark, basically. Actually, teal and purple, but we don't have to get into that. And so what you want to do is keep that gauge as much in the middle as possible, because if it goes all the way one side or the other, that's when you die. Except, maybe you do want to go one side or the other, because the more you go on the teal side by hitting obstacles that are, color-coded, so teal, it kind of imbues your character with more, verticality. And so you become not as fast, left to right. You don't jump as far, but you will jump higher. You will float a little bit. And, the opposite, if you go on the purple side, you don't jump as well, but you jump further and you definitely run faster. So that is kind of an interesting idea, a mechanic for a 2D platformer. And I was kind of excited to play with that a lot. And it kind of turns out that for, 80-90% of the game, you don't really need to, which was something that was kind of disappointing, and which is something that I kind of, that's where I kept expecting, cleverness. I kept expecting, well, the exit is very obviously here, but what if, what if I went all on the teal side, I got a higher jump and could somehow break the boundaries of this level, and, go up and find a different exit or something. And that never really happens. This is not that type of game. This game is very much, there's an obstacle course in front of you. It's pretty straightforward. And you execute the platforming that's in front of you, and you go to the next room. In a way, this was disappointing to me. Where this game is a little bit more interesting, and I did not feel that way initially because it takes a while to get going, is the story. So basically, this is not set in our world. This is set in a very similar world. Only the difference is this whole purple and teal energy thing. Turns out that's what the citizens of this world are using to power their machines, and it's basically what makes their society run. And they've been building these giant plants to extract that resource, and it is leading to an ecological, disaster, basically. you are an engineer sent to go fix, you know, something is wrong at the power plant. So you go to fix it. Your partner dies very quickly. And you're like, oh shit, this is serious. You manage to make it out of there and to repair the plant. But you kind of become like the mayor's kind of go-to, like, favorite to go like, oh, well, you know, you took care of this problem very well for us. It turns out we have other plants that have problems, and you're, you know, our best person to put on the case. So, you know, like, you're kind of turned into, like, a lot of responsibility is put on you, but also, like, you're kind of turned into, like, the mayor's, like, kind of grasping for your fame, basically, or whatever it is, like, trying to hold on to you as a way to get reelected, I suppose. Because you're kind of getting him out of a jam.
Yeah.
Initially, I didn't think that the writing was as good as in Anodyne. I was a little bit disappointing, but and you know, the platforming I thought was pretty straightforward and a little bit more simple than I thought. Like I did not encounter the friction that I expected going into it. I died very seldomly initially until like the last like 10th of the game. Finishing this game kind of turned around my opinion of it, just because turns out that the ending is very, very strong. I can't talk about it, but like it, I don't know, like I think it's going to stay with me for a while. And the last bit, like I would say the last third of the game in terms of platforming becomes a little bit more challenging, and that became more that was more like to my taste. And it started doing some of the things that I like, some of the more clever things that I was hoping that the game would do initially, like, because beyond like this whole, like, you know, horizontal and vertical energy thing, you've also got a shield, which, you just defend yourself with, but also, sometimes there are gusts of wind and you can, you know, if you align your shield, you can basically like direct it in the four directions, like up, down, left, right. And if you align it correctly, you can, basically use it as some sort of like, you know, kind of cartoon, like umbrella, like you can slow down your fall, or the opposite. You can jump higher if you've got a upward gust of wind. That's pretty cool. I would say also the puzzles just become much more interesting in that back half, where you do more interesting stuff with the shield. And anyway, most of the challenge is really like in the back half, as you would expect. But the beginning of the game is a little bit too simple. I think that they were perhaps like gearing this game to be like my first 2D platformer, perhaps. You start a game and like they're like, you know what, like this game has a lot of story, this game has a lot of platforming, we recommend both, but if you want, we can just have you, like, if you can't want, you can just have the story portions and not do the platforming at all, or the opposite, you can just do the platforming if you don't care for the story, but for your first run through, we would appreciate if you tried both. Also, if you dig deeper into the options, you can, you know, you can basically make yourself invulnerable to, like, you can not die from the energy going all, you know, all the way on one side or the other. So that's got, you know, those kind of accessibility options that I thought would, like, I thought that meant, oh, this is going to be Celeste. This is going to be a Super Meat Boy or something, but it really is not. All this to say, this game maybe didn't put its best foot forward, or maybe my expectations were coloring my initial impression of it, and also maybe it starts a little bit easy. I don't know. But in the end, I think it's a game worth playing just on the strength of that back half. And I gotta say, like, this is, you know, 2D pixel art, and the backgrounds can be really beautiful. Again, the first ones that you see are not the most beautiful ones. They're very much in this second half of the game, but it's really nice to look at. Like, eventually this game turns into kind of a looker. Anyway, so that's Even the Ocean. I would recommend it, but yeah, maybe like on a sale, like I would recommend it. And I'm looking forward to Anodyne 2 coming in like April, I believe, to Switch and other consoles. They went with a kind of a PlayStation like 3D look. So I'm looking forward to that. Cool. Other than that, I played Cyber Shadow. So has anyone else here? I kind of expected to be not the only one who played it.
No, I haven't played it yet.
I have not.
All right. Well, it is kind of the retro game of the moment, published by Yacht Club Games, the makers of Shovel Knight, although this is not, you know, developed by them. It's just published by them. But Cyber Shadow is a riff on Ninja Gaiden, although I think that they named other games as, like, Shadow of the Ninja or something as their main
influences.
Yeah,
they named a few, I think.
Yeah. But this is very much, like the game in that vein, except, so it is divided into levels that you can then go back to once you've accumulated power-ups. And so this is not a Metroid type progression, but it is kind of like there is backtracking at some point that you'll have to do if you want to pick up all the health pickups and the spirit or whatever it is that powers your magical shurikens. So there is backtracking, but it's not a Metroidvania. It is much more straightforward level design, and it is super challenging. I have died so many times. At some point, once I beat the game, it's going to tell me exactly how many times. I'm sure it's well over 100. This game doesn't pull its punches. You know, it feels mostly fair. There's maybe like a few parts of the game where I feel like they kind of laid it a little bit thick with the, you know, the platform that's hard to reach and the enemies that are shooting at you while you're trying to reach that platform, you know. In those moments, you do have like resources, like you can try to the game has checkpoints. It has maybe like fewer than I'd like, but it does have checkpoints. And eventually what you can do with the checkpoints is that at some of them, like you can spend this currency that you're earning throughout your game, you can spend this currency at them to make them give you power-ups. And then like once you've paid that, like it's permanent. Like they're always going to give you like that power-up or whatever it is that you chose to upgrade that checkpoint for. So that helps. Yeah, otherwise, like, this is a really tough challenge, and it is a game that is very much like, how many video game references can I fit in this thing? And they try to fit all of them. The composer of this game, I believe, is the same composer as Shovel Knight, so it's got that same kind of sound.
I don't think the primary composer is the same. I think Vert or Jake Kaufman consulted on it or, you know, did some contributions to it, but he's not the primary composer. Oh, it must forgive me for forgetting who that person actually is. I'm afraid. Yeah. I've read, you know, Neil's review, and so I do know the name somewhere, but it's just not coming to me at the minute.
All right. Well, all right, so not the not Jake Kaufman, but it does have that sound for most of it, except at times like the game very much just like, you like the Meridian music from Super Metroid? We like the Meridian music from Super Metroid. Here's something that sounds like it, you know. Here's the Castlevania song that's not, you know, tune, that's not a Castlevania tune, wink wink. There are those bits in there in the soundtrack, and it's the
Vampire
same thing.
Disruptor.
There's this, that's also going on visually. You know, like it didn't even register with me. But there's a very clear like Ninja Turtles kind of like hidden spot somewhere where you see like empty pizza boxes and skateboards and anyway. But like I did find like basically the Mario 3 Toad House. And at that point, I was like, well, that's a little bit much, guys. I like my old video games as much as the next guy, but like this is too many references.
Did it feel like they were just stopping the game to point and go, see, see?
Well, usually they put them out of the way. So this, I had to look for this Toad House, basically.
Okay.
But it was there, you know. I suppose that if you just fly through the game without trying to go out of the beaten path, you might never see them.
Like, when you say it's the Toad House, like, how on the nose are we talking here?
You know when you see it.
Okay.
You know? Like, there's just, it's just like, basically, I went over the screen, like, basically, like the way that you would get the three pipes in the 1-2 of Super Mario, the first one. Like the you go over the wall and anyway, but instead there were not three pipes, there were like three boxes.
Gotcha.
Anyway, so yeah, so lots of references. This game is really hard. Maybe a little bit too hard. Like I gotta say, like I think this is maybe a little bit more challenging than I was hoping for. And I now realize I'm saying that right after I said that even the ocean was not challenging enough. So the problem is probably me.
I thought if this is your third game for New Business will be just right.
Let's hope. Except no. But the
nothing
yeah, so,
is just right.
It never is. Very seldom is. But yeah, so this game is very challenging. And I guess like it, people seem to be loving it. Very early, at some point, I thought to myself, I feel like I'm playing this just because I started it. Like, I could feel the sunk cost fallacy that I was living through. Like, I could feel that, like, I'm at this point, I just want to see this through because I started it. And that was a while ago. Like, I stuck with it thinking, surely this game is not that long. Like, there's an achievement for finishing it under 3 hours. I don't know how you would do that. It's harder than I expected. It's longer than I expected. And tires me out. Like, it feels tiresome to play a little bit because it's so challenging. At the same time, I do feel sometimes that parts of the game that give me a lot of trouble, I could master if I practice more. Like, there's this bit where I just kept dying over and over this... There's this pit with very few platforms to stand on, lots of enemies. And at this point in the game, I've got this move where basically I can almost like teleport, like slice through enemies and kind of teleport horizontally doing so. And you can keep that, you can keep doing that. You can keep that up as long as you're killing enemies, basically. And so very clearly here, there's like, this is a sequence where you're supposed to go slash your way through like one enemy, like jump, slash your way the next enemy without ever touching the ground. It's just really hard to pull off. And this game is expecting you to be able to pull that off at that point in the game. And I feel like it's expecting a little bit too much of me. But again, like the controls are tight, the game, like the music is good. The game looks good. It's got this, I like the CRT kind of filter. Basically, I don't know if I'm just a complainer or if, there's something I'm missing here. But it is like it's a well-done game made by professionals, dare I say.
Oh, dear.
It's just not, well, you know, I don't think it's fully clicking with me, unfortunately.
No, that's fair. That phrase, like I like to imagine that there are people who come into the show and have like hear us say that phrase and go, oh no, and don't understand the origin of it, but eventually figure it out on their own.
Yeah, well, the way that we say it usually kind of tells a story, right? It's quite a good thing, right?
It's dabbing just... with faint praise.
Yeah, how faint was my praise?
Basically, we don't assign scores on this podcast, but that would be a 7, I suppose, out of 10.
Yeah, there's recommended, not recommended, and a well-made game clearly made by professionals. That's the score.
Usually that term gets reserved for games that there is either high anticipation for or there is some swell of like, oh, this is people like this.
Yeah.
Because it defines there is a certain like baseline of quality. Like, this is a professional product. This isn't Balan Wonderworld, which if you've not played the demo, you should. I'm just gonna say you should.
I had a little toy with it off the Japanese, because I think it was on the Japanese eShop first.
Yeah, it was by
so
Time Zones.
I I've got my Japanese account set up and. So I tried that before it kind of blew up on the internet, and yeah, it feels wonky as all shit. And then I was just like, yeah, all right, I'm not gonna persist with this. And then yeah, everything else, like, well, I was like, well, if I kept going, apparently it wouldn't have wouldn't have yielded anything particularly enjoyable.
The fact that the walking animation isn't the same distance as the actual walk stride is the most beautiful thing in the world. But that is the opposite. It is neither well made nor, well, it probably is made by professionals, but
it's made by the professionals at Arzest, I believe, or at least in part. Yoshi's New Island and, Hey Pikmin and so, yeah, which I don't hate those games, but at the same time, the full-on 3D platformer doesn't really seem like it's within their wheelhouse, considering even the side-scrolling stuff seemed like it was challenging their ability to be creative.
Published by Square Enix, a company that's not particularly interested in that genre.
Who made Thing Smash? Was it Goodfeel or was it Arzest?
I think it was when they were still R-Toon, because I don't think R-Toon collapsed, and I forget the exact circumstances, but yeah, Arzest is the reanimated corpse of R-Toon or whatever, so...
So Fling Smash, not very good, and yeah, I don't have any love for that company.
R-Toon made Fling Smash, yes. So the Balan Wonderworld, made by Arzest and published by Square Enix and led up development by a guy who hadn't really made a game since Billy Hatcher. So everything's going great.
His company, Prope, just, you know, let's tap. Choose your tapping game.
There's a big gulf there in terms
all I can name right now are DS and Wii games that also says something,
because it was there when I talked to him and he didn't mention it. I don't think he worked on Fishing Resort.
Okay.
I think he worked on Ivy the Kiwi and Let's Tap.
Ivy the Kiwi is also good.
Yeah, but it's a far cry from a 3D platformer.
Yeah,
it's also like 12 years old.
Yeah.
All right, so I guess I will go next on the new business rodeo. I have been playing Hyrule Warriors: The Age of Calamity. I actually mentioned last week that I'd started it, and six chapters in, seven, somewhere in there. So I'm not sure how far that puts me in terms of the overall game.
It's not that many sort of numbered chapters. I don't think they've got to get too far into that, but I played this over a very long period of sort of, I think the clock's at 40 hours now. And I've seen the credits roll, I guess, on the main story, but there's still loads of side missions to do. And a lot of my time was spent doing side missions and fiddling around. I mentioned this, several weeks ago, or however long it's been, about just the way that everything is on that one Sheikah Slate map.
Yes.
And I said I appreciate the sort of integration into the fiction, but it's not always the most expeditious for just getting what you want done, and also just it is very intentionally, sort of layering sort of systems and, upgrades, different kinds, all these different kinds of drops, and, there's leveling up the characters, leveling up the weapons, weapons that you kind of essentially like unlock because they start off as rusty, and then you can like take them to the blacksmith and get them de-rustified, and then they're like better weapons, and there's something to do with Octoroks. I mean, there is a concerted effort to layer like these sort of complexities on top of what is obviously a pretty bloody basic straightforward kind of game at its heart. I understand why they do that from one point of view, but also it's not always welcome. It just makes things more fiddly sometimes.
Yes. So I just checked. I just finished chapter 5, so there are 7 total. So I've got 2 left. So that's fine. I've been trying to keep up with To Greg's point, there are the chapter missions, and those are your big story chapters. They have remarkably long story sequences that lead off every one of them.
And also, the actual missions themselves can be quite protracted, whereas the side stuff is usually short. I mean, yeah, as you might expect.
Five-ish minutes usually for the side missions.
They can get longer as the game goes on.
Yeah,
you know,
and I've had a few that are like 15.
And naturally, of course, it depends like how, you know, what level you're at, or you know, you and your weapon, you know, like the missions would be drastically quicker if you're somewhat over leveled. The hot knife through butter thing, you know, kind of really does count here. And that's, you know, a lot of the Musou kind of games is, it's not about whether you can do something, because it's usually straightforward enough that, you know, anybody could do it. It's doing it quick enough, like before a base is going to fall, or, you know, this kind of things. And the part of that can be, you know, how adept you are at like dodging and whittling down the weak spots really quickly. And part of that can just be, you know, have you got the numerals to back it up?
There's sort of the third type of thing, which are the bring the drops to this point on the map and unlock a thing. And that could be an extra special move bar. That could be another heart for a character. That could be an additional move on the combo chain.
Yeah, the combo chain stuff's what I always focused on, because it does just make the characters somewhat more interesting. And, you know, I mentioned this before, anything that can help differentiate the characters from each other and add some kind of element to that. You know, it's always straightforward kind of stuff. It's just like, well, now if you press X after pressing Y four times, it'll do something, you know, different kind of thing. All these sorts of drops, you know, different bits of food, again, emulating Breath of the Wild as it does in every respect. All these sort of different bits of food and, you know, kind of drops from enemies and all that kind of thing. You have lots of them, but because there's so many of these things that appear on the map, like you are going to want to make choices about, well, what do you want to upgrade? Do you want the extra combos? Do you want the extra health? Do you want the special move meters that you mentioned, and you know, which characters do you want to kind of focus on? Like, are there ones that you really want to upgrade because you like them, or are there ones that you want to upgrade because they need to get better, otherwise you're not going to use them, all these sorts of things.
Yes, I've been up to now trying to clear pretty much all of those things, and it's just been a grind. And I think that's a mistake. I think I need to stop doing that, because I think it's just making everything take forever. Because there are so many of them. Now, but the problem is, occasionally you'll see one and it results in, you know, you do four of them or something, and it results in unlocking a new character. I've had two of those so far, where I unlocked the fairy fountain fairies.
Yeah, that is one of the, yeah, there's a handful of characters that are, you know, seemingly completely optional. Like you said, you know, you might not even necessarily encounter them, if you don't engage with some of this optional content, and they are some of the wackiest characters, just like, really. Musou games, very Hyrule Warriors, you had loads of wacky stuff in it, and remember saying beforehand, kind of like, in Breath of the Wild, it seems a bit harder to have the wacky, you know, kind of elements to it. But, you know, it was a relief to see some more humorous and just bizarre things in the game.
Yeah, like the fairy fountain is particularly confounding. But like Hetsu is in here as a playable character, which really brings into question all kinds of stuff about the actual source game then. But Hetsu is an awful character, and I have found playing with Hetsu to be horrible. Just because it takes forever to do the damage necessary to do anything.
A lot of the sort of wackier characters as well tend to put more strain on the game running, as this is obviously a prominent part of the discourse about the game, is the frame rate and stuff. And like, I think with a number of characters, where they kind of summon things, like extra stuff, and that can really, like Impa is one of those characters that kind of has, yep, like, and she's, yeah, pretty well in the mainstream of the characters, but yeah, I did find myself kind of, hedging, going away from those a little bit, just game man a bit better.
Yeah, Hetsu is very bad. Another one of those characters that I unlocked, I won't go and name all the characters just because that is part of the joy here, but unlocked in a very similar way to the fairies. Summons big giant items and then blows them up. And I mean like big giant pieces of geometry, and the game is like, fuck, what are you doing? And I'm like, I don't know, man, you made this. This is your fault. I think actually my biggest kind of annoyance with it is the load times in this game are just savage.
Pretty juicy. I mean, they disguise them a bit with the story missions because they'll have some narration in the, right, in the build-up. But, of course, yeah, when you do inside missions and all that, when you don't have that, then yeah, the loads are still generally, you know, pretty big, and there really isn't any, and like you said, shorter missions in themselves. So then you really start to notice it more if you try and just chain a bunch of, say, for instance, it's one of these things where, cause you can like put, like you've got these, this facility to like highlight quests that will give you an item that you're lacking to,
right,
fulfill the needs of, you know, like, oh, I want to upgrade this character's combos. Well, I need this drop. So let's, activate this tracking device ostensibly that puts a green highlight on quests that can help me with that. So say for instance, if you're then like trying to chain some of those quests in quick succession to build things up, like that's where you feel the load times more.
Oh yeah. And that's where I've been feeling it. It's like, I need to go get, so commonly it's the proof of victory over like a Lionel. Well, there's not a lot of missions where you can get more than one Lionel. So you're really just looking for a mission where you can kill a Lionel and get out of it quickly. And there's one where the mission is basically kill a Lionel,
Hinox.
The Hinox, yeah. And that's the mission. It's just kill Lionel, kill Hinox. And the only character I have that can kill them very fast is Link. So I have run that mission with Link like 3 times just to get those.
I've tried to avoid running repeat missions as much as I can. Again, it's just kind of one of those things that I've done gradually over time. Like, as I try to just avoid getting too, like, trying to do everything, all that kind of stuff. Especially when I still had the main chapters to do. But I did find myself spending longer without doing the main chapters, mainly because they were quite long. So right. A lot of the time I was just like, oh, well, you know, I don't know whether I can really, obviously look, it's a Switch. You can always set it to sleep or whatever, but I did kind of feel like, no, I want to at least mostly see this through in like a sitting rather than like come back to it a day or like several hours later and kind of lose the thread of it. Although it would never be that complex. Anyway, but yeah, I felt like, oh, this is going to be really long. I'll put that off for a bit and do some short stuff. You know, in between.
Yeah. And so I had been doing a pretty good job just keeping the quest stuff up to date, but I've fallen off on that a little bit just to advance the story. But it is really grindy in that respect. Now, not for levels though, because the little guardian is constant. So the little guardian will pop up and give you a directive on something you should take a look at. Like, oh, look at this. It makes its beeping whistle noise and it like points to it on the map, and it just keeps pointing to the guy who will just sell you level ups for your non-Link characters.
Yeah, well, it's just whoever's the highest level, that's right, like the level cap for everybody, but yeah, you can bring everybody up to that level for rupees, which again is another resource. You know, you get rupees for winning battles and sometimes for fulfilling quests with, you know, all the other drops or whatever, but it's a resource to be managed. So again, if I was going around sort of willing like all the quests and stuff that relied on rupees, I would have been kind of leaving myself a bit shorter for keeping the characters leveled up. So that came a thing that over time was like, I'll save my money for leveling up the characters rather than doing each and everything. So I guess the question is going to be how much I come back to any of that stuff now that I'm on the other side of the credits, but I've not really delved into it enough since then to say just yet.
I don't know. I just haven't felt myself connecting with the other characters. A lot of them have a weird gimmick, but a lot of times I feel like managing the gimmick isn't particularly fun.
There's a few characters, I'm not sure whether you would have had these yet or not, actually, because again, my recollection's not that great of it. Just the sequencing of it, again, because I spent so long between like the big chapters. But
I meant like 12 characters at this point.
Certain characters come in it actually have like timed button press elements to their, you know, kind of attributes, which is you know, it's hardly like particularly.
It's in a Bayonetta.
It's not. Yeah, it's not exactly pioneering, and no, it's not exactly as sophisticated as you know, the sort of real character action games. You know, that you might think of that being a staple feature of, but it's nice. It's kind of that some of the characters have like not just sort of kind of their own spin on certain things, but actually ends up making them play, you know, somewhat significantly different from the others because there's that extra element in there. So I feel like in the end, I was a bit concerned whether it was going to be as varied in terms of the character diversity as the previous Hyrule Warriors. But I think obviously the roster is smaller. There's no, and it draws from one place, so it is less varied in that sense. But no boats, no what was it, the girl from Link's Awakening that was in DLC and all that.
Oh but, yeah, Tetra or whatever.
Well, yeah, Tetra was the Wind Breaker.
Taryn, yes. Marin and Taryn.
Was it Marin and Taryn? I forget which one is which, but yeah, it's not as like gloriously silly and diverse in that sense, but you know, I felt like the range of different things that the characters could do, it worked out pretty well, and at least it's not like so many characters that it's like keeping them all like with their combos and their level and their weapons and all. I mean, it's tough enough as it is, to be honest, to keep all of them in up to snuff. So I'm not sure if I would like push for the roster to be bigger.
Imagine if you were playing the first Hyrule Warriors with the 3DS content and you got Taryn and suddenly a seagull. Like, and you hadn't played that game and didn't understand that reference. That would be extremely confusing.
Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of confusing even knowing that reference. Like, what does that say about that character? But it would be incredibly confusing if you didn't have that information. It reminds me very much of the Dark Place episode where he goes, I know some writers who use subtext. They're cowards. I find that I just kind of grind through this game, Age of Calamity, and I haven't really been having a great time with it, but it's a time killer.
It works so, you know, so much as a portable game. I really can't. I mean, again, don't play a lot of Switch on the TV anyway, but I really couldn't imagine. And I didn't play a lot of Hyrule Warriors or Fire Emblem Warriors on the TV, you know, going back, you know, even to Wii U in that, where, you know, the image quality of Hyrule Warriors on Wii U was not that good on the gamepad at times, I've got to say, but, you know, it was always that kind of game, and this one, just even more so, I think, slightly, just the way these sorts of quests are kind of set up. I felt like Fire Emblem Warriors was more, there was a, obviously it wasn't like actually like a Fire Emblem game or anything, but there was a little more sort of emphasis on like holding bases, and you did have like the weapon triangle was kind of built into the game a little bit, so you're having particular characters at particular bases to hold them or to take them was important. You know, you wanted a favorable matchup, and you know, you haven't really got any of that here, even though, you know, it's also a lot of warfare, but it's just, you know, it's not the same. It's just against kind of soulless grunts and, you know, monsters and stuff. So it feels like it's not, again, you know, we're talking about a Musou game in both cases, but it just, I quite like that little bit of sort of extra wrinkles and sophistication. Calling it sophistication's a bit much, but you know what I mean?
Just an extra layer to it.
Some little veneer of, yeah, and that also was kind of a reference, or, you know, kind of acknowledgement of elements of the source material in Fire Emblem's case, which you don't really have here. But I guess, you know, the same was largely true of Hyrule Warriors.
Yeah. I mean, I'm going to finish it, but I think I've reached the point where I just want to get through it, which sucks, because I really liked the first Hyrule Warriors game. I don't know what the difference is here. Maybe it's just the extra silliness of that game.
Yeah, it's not. I don't think it's as fun. I think, obviously, it is. It's in terms of where I say it has fun in its narrative and its aesthetics and all that kind of thing. Not so much in the, you know, the fun as in gameplay mechanics and all that. I mean,
and certainly it wasn't load times were faster, because the Wii U's load times were nightmares.
Also a fair point. Yeah, I can only assume the definitive edition on Switch was better, at least. That's generally how those sorts of things have gone, although I have not played it, you know, to confirm. But yeah, it just, again, I sort of wondered about this when it was, you know, announced and all that. The nature of the narrative and the subject matter, even though it is kind of meant to be about avoiding, you know, all the bad stuff that happens in Breath of the Wild, it is still a lot heavier than the crazy. I mean, Hyrule Warriors is about someone who has a crush on Link, basically. Like, that's the whole. That's the whole source of the problem.
Yeah, pretty much.
As I remember it. I mean, it's been a few years.
It's about two someones who might actually be one someone who have a crush,
like,
on
someone,
Link.
Someone like ends up getting like dark crystalled over their crush for Link, right? They become two extremes.
One becomes Hatsune Miku and the other becomes weird fetish wizard. Yeah. And
That's the source of all the trouble. Whereas this, obviously, because it's, you know, trying so hard to be embedded in the Breath of the Wild world and feel like it's, you know, the same place and the same people, that it's like it's got to sort of show like more reverence for the source material. And I guess, yeah, for people who were really attached to Breath of the Wild on a narrative level, that, yeah, that's who they're going for. I mean, I love Breath of the Wild, but I wasn't, you know, I mean, the story, A, wasn't that important. B, there wasn't that much of it. And C, what there was of it, I wasn't desperately attached to.
I think what's interesting is the light touch storytelling of Breath of the Wild. And that's probably how I would describe it. Like, there is a decent amount of narrative there, but it's more observational narrative than just like, here is a plot dump moment.
Yeah, yeah. And it becomes interspersed with goodness knows how many hours of exploration and gameplay and all the rest of it. So it's not, like I said, spoon fed on like this regular basis in big amounts.
Yeah. I mean, you come across a place and it's blown the fuck up and you're like, well.
There's nice moments in this in terms of seeing things in their pre, you know, calamity state and, you know, all that kind of stuff. Like, it's, and just how faithful a lot of the recreations are of the Hyrule locations and all that. There's plenty to be had out of their faithfulness to their fidelity to Breath of the Wild, even if you weren't like that big into the story and characters of Breath of the Wild. There's still lots to be had because there's just so much of the world because it's meant to be the same one.
I was just kind of amused by how Breath of the Wild storytelling works because it's so light touch. It feels very. Like, for lack of a better word, and this is going to sound really weird, Breath of the Wild's world is very empty. It's in the name. Like, there's not a bunch of people. There's a bunch of stuff happening. Like, there are some towns. You occasionally encounter people out on the road. But by and large, it is a world that has been depopulated. And as a consequence, there's not people around to tell Link the story. And so Link just kind of fumbles around and figures things out for himself.
And then he has the reveries, you know, when you get to a particular place to match the image in the Sheikah's light or whatever, and then you get the flashback.
Right. And that's it in terms of plot. Here's 3 minutes and we're out. I would argue some of these chapters in the Age of Calamity have been like as long as multiple story sequences in Breath of the Wild. Like three or four story sequences worth of Breath of the Wild content.
But that's what I mean, though. It feels like it's for people who wanted, you know, who liked. And I liked, you know, I felt somewhat effective, the storytelling in Breath of the Wild,
right.
But I didn't necessarily think, God, I need more of it, or God, I need it more conventionally.
Yeah.
This is much more like, oh, you know, you like those characters? Well, now you actually get to see them, you know, like in action and together and for a protracted period of time. I could see the appeal of that for a lot of people, but just not that much for myself.
Yeah, it turns out these characters aren't super deep, and like they don't really do anything when they interact because they weren't created to be. Like, they were created to make a couple quips in a cutscene, and then like when you meet their ghost, go like, "Well, I did what I could. It's your problem now, buddy. Later." And now when they're trying to like wrap plot around them, it feels a little awkward and weird. I do think we have the same problem coming up with Breath of the Wild 2. And I want to talk about this real quick before we move on. One thing this game has been doing has been making me think a lot about Breath of the Wild. And I had already been thinking a lot about Xenoblade X, and those two games are inextricably linked because of what they do. This sense of like, just here is a big dumb world. You can go wherever you want right now. We're not going to stop you. It's probably not a good idea, but go for it. And just explore. And you literally map the world, and you figuratively map the world in your head. And I played both of these games and was doing literal expeditions. I would prepare, I'd get supplies ready, and then I would pick a direction and start going. And I wonder how they're going to replicate that sensation in Breath of the Wild 2, because that's what made it so successful. But we're in a world we've already been in. So how much do they feel like they need to explore the world we've already been in? And like, I don't really need to explore Akala again. I know Akala pretty well. I know what's up there. I know where the town is.
One of the strengths I felt like of this game and its fidelity to that world is having not played, I played Breath of the Wild an enormous amount, but in a quite concentrated time. And that time was almost 4 years ago.
Yep.
So it brings this does bring back memories quite powerfully at times of, you know, playing Breath of the Wild and all that kind of stuff. So I think that's definitely my favorite part of how faithful it is. But yeah, I guess in a way that's spoiled possibly. Like, if that was any part of the appeal of Breath of the Wild 2, like, you know, like,
right.
Oh, you haven't been here for years, but now you're back here. It's like, well, actually,
I was just here 6 months ago.
That's been diluted a bit now. But, I mean, how much, you know, they will be incorporating the old world, or what exactly is going on? Something was going into the sky in that teaser or something. I mean, like, we know so little.
Yeah. It just raises the question of like, so much of Breath of the Wild's appeal, at least to me, was that whole sense of, here is a big wide open world. You do not know what is out there. Good luck. And just finding stuff. Like I joked about at the time, I found the town, the coastal town, the one that's sitting in like the bay. I found it like 70 hours into the game completely by accident. I was gliding and just dropped down and landed in a town. I'm like, what the fuck is this? The fuck did this come from? So if it's in the same world, I don't know how they replicate that charm. But
yeah.
I don't know.
And also, I mean, part of it was as well the fact that, oh, well, you know, this is a deviation from the 3D Zelda formula that existed to that right. point, and kind of discovering that this new, you know, template for 3D Zelda. And again, if it's, but you know, just a sort of a new iteration in the template established by Breath of the Wild, which we can only assume it will be, even whatever the physical kind of places you're exploring, it's going to be less of a kind of, it's going to have less of the feel of going into the unknown. Because yep. you have already kind of had that kind of experience before, so it'll be difficult to recapture that feeling of discovery that you had with Breath of the Wild. So I think they better be ready with other ways to enjoy the game, you know, profoundly. Because I just, if you try and just recapture that, you probably won't be successful.
Yeah. All right, well, we should move on. All right, John.
Yeah.
What are you up to?
Yeah, so what have I been playing that is relatively new but also incredibly old has been Baldur's Gate Enhanced Edition, and this is sort of part of the same stable of re-releases that Guillaume has been playing when he was playing Planescape Torment.
Yes.
From Beamdog. And yeah. So Baldur's Gate is always a game that I've been really curious about. I mean, it came out in 1998. Of course, it came out a month after Ocarina of Time. So at that point, I did not give a crap about Baldur's Gate. I was playing the heck out of Ocarina of Time. And at that time, I really wasn't a big PC gamer to begin with. So, but this was the big RPG in that time period. And of course, it was followed by Baldur's Gate too. But yeah, very, very well-known, legendary game. Got really good. I remember getting rave reviews when it first came out. And so I've always wanted to try it. And also, I'm a big fan of kind of the AD&D based RPGs that are true to the rule set and, you know, have all the, you know, kind of, you know, your weapons, they don't have damage. They have, you know, they list the die rolls for them and all that kind of, all of that kind of stuff, which I don't totally understand, but I kind of love at the same time. And, you know, they have your Thaco, like your to hit armor class zero and all that kind of stuff, which, I used to like back in the day with, the really, really old school, SSI gold box games. Right. That's where I was kind of first exposed to it, but. Yeah, and Baldur's Gate is very much in that tradition, where you can do a whole lot in this game, and you can play this game a whole lot of ways. It's isometric viewpoint, and it doesn't really try, even though it is kind of a re-release of it. I can't really remember what the visuals were like originally, but they are not upgraded very much as far as I can tell.
I think
they are like what you are seeing now.
I think you'd be surprised. I think the resolution definitely wasn't as high, and so like mm-hmm. the view mm-hmm. would have been way closer.
I just
like they're not they don't look like 2020 games, but they've done work that I really came to appreciate when I played Planescape on Switch, and then I switched to the original version on my PC, and I was like, whoa, I'm not doing that again.
yeah. So, yeah, I mean, I never played it on PC, so I'm completely, I'll buy that. But yeah, these games, they look like old school games. They play like old school games. They're not trying to really hold your hands at all. But that being said, I mean, there's a certain charm I find about these games because they don't really hold your hand at all. You have to kind of do everything manually. I think that, you know, of course with it being a PC game, the question is always, you know, how are the controls going to work? And they do it mostly through radial menus, which works pretty well. Mm-hmm. The only thing I really couldn't get a real grip on, battle is kind of weird. I still don't totally know what I'm doing if I have to. It's because battle, whenever you encounter an enemy, everything pauses. Mm-hmm. And I think that's to allow you to probably set up your characters somehow. But
Yeah. So you can switch that in the menus. You can, like, there's all sorts of options to that you like. You can toggle on or off this, like, auto pause when combat starts and things like that. Or you could have it pause every time that you do an action, which would be incredibly tedious. But it's like, I guess it's one way to simulate turn-based combat. But this is, you know, mostly real time. And the combat, yeah, like that's one thing about, and that's one of the reasons why I like Planescape specifically. It's kind of a visual novel, and the combat is an afterthought. And so I did not engage with the combat too much, but if you do, and I think you have to in Baldur's Gate, then you're kind of looking at lots of radial menus, as you mentioned, and kind of switching between characters and telling each character what to do. Although I think that you can set them to do certain things, like you can, like they've got AI, they can kind of, they've got some autonomy, but you could also just micromanage them if you wanted.
Yeah, that's kind of what I'm trying to figure out right now, is how much I want to micromanage them, because if you, on the one hand, if you don't micromanage them and then you just kind of set their AI to attack, battles feel like kind of chaotic, like you never really know what's going on. Because the thing is, you have four characters right now. I have four characters in my party, and it's just like a gang war breaks out if you fight a bunch of monsters, and it's just basically people hitting everything everywhere. So I may very well, and I'm used to the older games where, talking about like the Gold Box games, where that was very much character by character. This character goes and you choose what they do. This character goes and you choose what they do. And then it also did that for all of the enemies as well. So it got fairly absurd at the end of the game, because you would fight, you know, you had six characters in your party and you would be fighting mobs of enemies. You would be fighting like 30 enemies. And so you would sit there and you would choose what your six characters are going to do. And then the computer would go through every single enemy, 30, 40 enemies, every single one. So the enemies in the back, because they couldn't attack you if they didn't have any range attacks, it would just be guard, 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 guard. But you had to sit there and watch the computer go through every single one of those transactions. So I'm trying to still get used to the combat of it. I'm going to have to dig into the menus and kind of just see. I went through the combat tutorial. But going through the tutorial doesn't really prepare you for being able to think on the fly and being able to react on the fly to what enemies are doing. And also, you know, switching, maybe potions that you have or weapons that you're using or spells that you're using. I mean, I haven't even touched magic at all. And this is very, very much old school. You get a scroll, you learn the scroll, you know, you learn the spell and stuff like that.
Yeah, one of the issues when I played Planescape is that I never, you know, played Dungeons & Dragons, so I'm not familiar with the terminology and the rules. And so the game does explain a few things to you, but maybe not enough to my taste. So because Chromatic Orb is a higher level spell than a Magic Missile, I understand that the Chromatic Orb is probably more powerful, and I've got fewer uses of them. But I don't really know, like, why is Magic Missile not that good? You know, like So there's kind of a learning curve if you've never played Dungeons and Dragons, like just learning the terminology and who's, you know, like which enemies are scary and which are not. Like I don't know enough about this universe and these rules and these attacks and all of that to really know. But yeah, anyway, you kind of learn as you go, right?
Yeah, like you have a sword that is, like, one sword is 2d4 damage and the other sword is 1d8. And I think conceptually that's an 8-sided die versus 2 4-sided die, I guess.
Which one sells for the most money? That's probably the one that I want to keep, you know. That's how I went.
Yeah. But then you get into kind of the mathematical part of it, where I was like, okay, well, what damage do I want here? And so, of course, I looked it up online, and it's, of course, you wind up in a forum and it's a bunch of people just completely nerding out over the mathematical possibilities of one die versus the other die. And basically where they settled on was you probably have, so you have a maximum, if like 2d4 versus 1d8, you have a maximum of 8 damage. But probably doing it with the 2d4, you have a higher chance, I think, of rolling of like, of basically getting 4.5 damage. So it's crazy. Anyways, I'm not going to go into that. However, you have a higher chance, like with like 1d8, you have a higher chance of doing 8 damage, but you also have a higher chance of doing 1 damage. Whereas with 2d4, you will probably land, you have a more likely chance of landing somewhere in the middle and not going really high, but also not going really low. So, and they don't really explain that very well in the game either. But I mean, I'll probably have to dig into maybe some of their help files or something and just kind of familiarize myself with that. But it's cool.
Intro to statistics class is pretty, that was a while ago now.
Yeah, it's exactly. But yeah, I mean, I'm enjoying it. I mean, it's pretty slow paced, and you can go, you know, you can go as fast or slow as you want, right? Like, it's a pretty big world. The map layout is kind of weird. Like, you're on like a map of a certain size, and then you go to the edge of it, and then you kind of go out to the world map, and then choose the next place to go. So that's kind of weird, but you know, takes some getting used to. But yeah, overall, I mean, the story hasn't really unfolded too much. There's apparently iron on the Gold Coast where it's set is or the Sword Coast, sorry. It's weak, apparently. There's something that's weakening all of the iron, so weapons and tools and stuff like that are breaking a lot, and so you have to kind of figure that out, and you get a whole bunch of side quests.
Have they tried the sharpening the iron with steel?
Well, that would work.
Like, oh, sorry, I got it backwards.
Because that's how metallurgy works, Guillaume.
Because the iron is so brittle. I see.
I mean, I know what I would recommend.
Yeah, what you would recommend is failure.
Mm-hmm.
Again, more corrections necessary because of John Lindemann.
Yeah, but you know, I'm enjoying it so far. Iron sharpens steel. That's my last comment.
It does not. It doesn't do that. It doesn't. That's why we invented steel, John.
Before we get into that too deep, I've got a few questions. With Planescape Torment in the package came Icewind Dale, which was another one of those. I think it came out after Planescape Torment, Baldur's Gate 1. I'm not sure if it came out before or after Baldur's Gate 2. But I tried to start it once I was done with Planescape, and it just asked me to create like 6 characters. Which I felt was like too much for me because I don't know. Like, aren't you supposed to party with like friends and stuff? You create one character. Other people take care of the rest, right? Like,
yeah, in these versions, there's no multiplayer like there was in the original PC.
Right. Games. Yeah. You can't do LAN parties, what you're saying, with your Switch or Xbox. That's too bad.
Exactly. So they give you the choice up front. And this was something where, a character generator like this, it is the worst possible thing that you can ever give me, because once I figure out what the theoretical maximum is for the role, because I mean you sit there and you have your character sheet with however many stats you have, 6 or whatever, and each of them gets each of them has a maximum of 18, and so of course there's a theoretical maximum role, and it's like each one is a die roll, right?
Yeah.
And so I sat there. I don't even know how many hours I sat there trying to get the best roll I could get. I mean, we're talking 4 hours probably, 5 hours. Just sitting there, because you would typically get rolls within, like, I think the highest roll I ever saw was a 95. Most of them were like maybe 74, 75, 76 in there. But I would just sit there forever. And of course, the clicker, the more, and it's just literally sitting there clicking your A button. Click, 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 new roll, new roll, new roll. And, you know, and of course, the more you do that, the harder it is to actually stop on a good roll. So you'll see like a good roll and you just go right by it and just be like, God damn. But yeah, just completely like, just that, like, if you want to talk about like, that's my personality, like, I will sit there. I will not sleep until I get like pretty much the best role that I can get,
and or then at least you have to do something I'm happy with. 5 other characters.
Yes. Yeah. And that's the thing. That's why I only rolled one character, because I refuse to put myself through that anymore for yeah, five other great. Characters. So I just said, whatever, just, you know, fill out the rest.
Give me your garbage.
I recognize my limits. I'm not doing this and also you're absolutely right. Hit the nail on the head. Is like, I don't really know the different, like, the strengths and weaknesses of the different characters or classes, I should say, and races and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. To really properly craft a character for each type of class.
Yeah, not to just keep pushing Planescape on people, but one of the reasons why I really liked it is because it kind of does away with a lot of that D&D BS, I suppose. Like, it is set with, like, it does use those rules and stuff, but because of the story, first, like, your companions, you don't create them. They're already, it's more like a JRPG party, I suppose. Like, you can find some characters, have them join your party, and they're already created, and they're kind of fully featured already. They've got a, you know, like, you don't have to select anything for them, basically, unless when, until you level up. And your main character is immortal, so you kind of don't have to do anything in the combat if you don't want to. Like, you can just keep running up to an enemy and keep trying to stab it, even though it's not a good strategy. And eventually you might kill it and get some XP and then level up enough to make it through. So in many ways, Planescape Torment is a little bit opaque, and, you know, it kind of be a bit scary because it's an even weirder version of Dungeons and Dragons. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, I find that it just has a lot of things that make it more approachable to people who don't play Dungeons and Dragons. Icewind Dale, I was just like, nope. Like, as soon as I kind of had my party created, I don't think I played with that too much. And like some, like, okay, I'm at a bar, and like some guys just like, hello, strangers, here are some adventures that you can go on. And I'm like, this sucks. This is terrible.
I mean, Baldur's Gate is like that. Like, you have to realize that there's like a learning curve. You have to kind of accept that going in. Yeah. You know, it's not just going to give everything to you, and you're going to have to figure some stuff out and probably do a little research on the side just to figure out kind of, you know, get a grip of the, like, the combat system is fairly simple, but what everything means, because it is very much, it uses the AD&D rule set. So it's very much like, you know, it is that everything about the armor classes and all that kind of stuff. Like, it's, you know, it doesn't try to stray from that. It throws it right in your face. So
one last thing I'll say is that I was listening to a podcast recently where someone else was doing a Baldur's Gate, like going back to those games. I think he had played them before. And one of the things he said was that the Baldur's Gate 1, not really worth going back to, which I was kind of surprised by. But apparently Baldur's Gate 2 is the one that everyone was like, whoa. Because it has this, like, it mostly takes place in this one central town. And immediately, like, there's so many side quests that you can go on. And anyway, it was kind of like an achievement in just amount of stuff that you can do in a game. And it also has kind of the stronger story. And so I don't know. Like, if you end up kind of, I don't know how you feel right now about Baldur's Gate, the first one, but if you end up like bailing out on it, maybe try the second one.
Yeah. I mean, the story right now isn't knocking my socks off. I mean, it's right. Like, ooh, yeah, the iron that's coming in and being imported in here is weak. Ooh, that's, it's not exactly compelling. It's not exactly pulling me into the story.
Yeah.
But
get better iron, John.
I guess.
You or make steel so it'll be strong. Is there the great courses for metallurgy? John needs to learn about metallurgy. All right. Well, that is going to do it for new business. When we come back, we will do a corrections and some listener mail. So stay tuned. We are back with a listener mail, just the one, because we're going to try to keep the episode shorter this week. But we're going to start with a correction from last week's email segment. This is from the real or not real party games email that GX sent us. The specific question if you missed the episode, you should go listen to it. But GX sent us a list of a great number of games with the word party in them, most of which were alarmingly real, some of which he made up. In many cases, the ones he made up were not even the most disturbing ones, so that was fun. But there was one game in particular called Monopoly Party. And do you gentlemen remember if that was real or fake?
Well, we all said it was real, and then yes. John proclaimed to our surprise that it was not.
Yes. Well, it turns out that GX also, John did not screw it up. The spreadsheet says quite clearly it is fake. And GX believed it was fake. However, we were later corrected that, in fact, there is a GameCube game called Monopoly Party.
Yeah.
I can believe it.
None of us feel good about this because we're like, oh, we were right about another game we didn't want to be real being real. GX feels bad about this because he did not want it to be real. And, quote, I have a mea culpa. Monopoly Party is real. It was GameCube, but did not show in GameStop's database. It was basically, I asked him, did he make that one up or was the document a mistake? And he responds, quote, it was basically, I feel Monopoly Party should be a thing, is it? And then he checked GameStop's database. No, it's not. Huh. I should write that one down. And then I concluded I would have to have a correction segment. We then had a discussion about other things to make sure they weren't real, and I do not believe there were any other misses. So our mistake, Monopoly Party is real, that party minigame thing becomes ever slightly more upsetting, and it was already extraordinarily upsetting. That's our corrections for the week. So with that, emails. You can send your emails to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. That is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. And GX actually has the email for the week because, it gave me a lead into the correction segment. But also, it's a beefy email. We were looking for a beefier email topic. GX writes, I say this, so GX actually wrote the GX writes parts in the email. Nobody ever does that because I usually do that in the notes I send out. GX writes, parenthetically, I say this because John doesn't look at the end. He just reads verbatim starting from the email account sender
hold
name.
Hold on a second. I don't understand this ad hominem attack on me. I don't get it.
It's not ad hominem when it's true, John. You did do that. You can't be ad hominem when it happens.
Iron sharpened steel, god damn it.
God damn it. Dear RFN crew, as the resident Discord Sonic fan, that franchise is currently going through a changing of the Western Guard as it prepares to launch its sixth animated series next year. Iconic English voice actors and writers/localizers are being replaced for the first time in a decade. Their predecessors, the 4Kids cast, that also dubbed Sonic X, lasted about 5 to 8 years. It's been a series that actively avoided finding a unified identity in the early years and still rapidly shifts identity now. However, when I look to Mario, even when the platforming or racing go-karts or turn-based RPGing, it never feels that removed from Mario being Mario and his world being Mario's world. Charles Martinet and his reliable over-the-top voice, mushrooms give you some form of health or energy, Koopa shells are propelled forward as a projectile weapon, stars make you invincible, and you want to collect coins for no other reason than the act of collecting them is lizard brain satisfying. What do you see as Mario's identity, and how is Mario able to maintain it? What other Nintendo franchise maintains strong identity? Is there something inherent to Nintendo's design, Nintendo's brand management, or even just Nintendo's persistence or consistency that gives certain franchises identity over others? Thanks. So GX is the Sonic expert in the NWR Discord. He, in fact, writes for a Sonic-focused website. He does a Sonic stream every Sunday. He knows his stuff, and I would occasionally in the Discord make jokes about like Sonic franchises that are too dumb to live. Like I would make up a franchise that the Sonic that was announced this week is a Netflix series and I forgot the name already. But I made fun of it because the press
Sonic
release
Prime.
Sonic Prime. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I made fun of it because the press already. Release they put out was very stupid. And it not for any particular reason. It was just the bullet points they put out.
I mean, have they already used Sonic Extreme? Has that been used already?
I'm confident the
problem is that was the name of that sort of ill-fated Saturn
yes.
Sonic project that never saw the light of day. So
One of them, anyway.
Yeah, it may have been multiple projects, but there were some demos of glimpses of Sonic in 3D, essentially, but of course didn't happen outside of like the little hub like thing for Sonic Jam, the compilation on Saturn. So yeah, that's what I think of when I think of Sonic Extreme. Could there have been other things? I think there might well have been.
Yeah, I basically just quoted the press release where it was like, I can't remember what phrase they were using. It was like looking for high action with fun content for all ages. And it was like, this is the most nothing ass email that I've ever seen.
It's kind of interesting in a way that this is, because obviously it was about a year ago that the Hollywood Sonic film released.
Yes.
And so that, I guess it's, the success of that is somewhere connected to this, like, that gave us the platform to kind of freshen things up, but at a higher level of prestige than otherwise would have been the case. Like, is that what's going on here?
I don't think so. So I think legitimately, Near as I can tell, this is just... So there was a Sonic series that wrapped up relatively recently.
Sonic Boom.
There is the ongoing comic book series, which has been rebooted a couple times. And there was a series before Sonic Boom, and then there were a bunch of series before that. I think it's just legitimately... you see this in animation a bit. There's this theory that... If you're making animation aimed at a younger audience or TV shows aimed at a younger audience, that you've really got a fixed number of seasons no matter how successful it's been. And in fact, this happens with Disney Channel quite frequently. They basically say, we're going to do 3 seasons and then we're done. It doesn't matter how popular the show is, because your audience ages out and the next generation doesn't want to watch their older sibling show. They want their own show. They don't want to come in late. They want to be there. This is my show. I'm not watching my big brother's show, for example. And so you reboot the series after a few years, regardless of how it's doing, just to get that fresh start with a new generation of kids, because your original audience has aged out of it. And that could be some of it. It could just be that the license for Sonic Boom ended and the production company's license ended, and Netflix was willing to flash the cash and got their own series. And so we have Sonic Prime now. And so it is, I don't know. I think part of it is just, I don't know if Sega doesn't care. They care. That's not fair. It's not fair to say that they don't care. I just wonder if maybe they're just more hands off than Nintendo, because we've heard about for Super Nintendo World is how like this has been Miyamoto's like singular focus.
Well, but then there's the movie as well. Yeah. But he's quite involved with that, and just this notion that years ago a Super Mario movie happened, and it was not necessarily something that Nintendo was thrilled with, or that many people on the face of the earth were thrilled with.
Yeah.
So ever since then, they pretty much just put the drawbridge up, and any subsequent kind of ventures in that vein, they would have a much greater degree of control over. And then, of course, once you got to the unhappy times of, you know, sort of Wii U bombing, then all the, there was pressure to start leveraging their properties in any way they could. But even still, you know, the amount of kind of editorial kind of oversight seems like they vow, you know, they fulfilled that kind of vow of like, well, if we're going to do it, we're going to do it right. Which means for us, you know, it's not going to embarrass us. It's not going to confuse people, or it's not going to kind of dilute the brand or whatever. Like, so I guess that's where the, it kind of comes back around to this question of identity. You know, and I do feel like the Mario thing is, it's evolved over the years because, you know, once upon a time, Mario was just the everyman character that was just in everything.
Right.
You know, like the really early going before even, you know, Super Mario Brothers had kind of established itself as the flagship Nintendo franchise. You know, he just like, well, we put him in all these different things. He's kind of the golfer in golf, and, you know, he's the ref in Punch Out and all this kind of stuff, your Wrecking Crew. You know, you could just sort of put him in everything. So he necessarily doesn't have a strong identity. He's kind of a placeholder. He's kind of a self-insert character to some extent. And then, of course, once Super Mario Brothers does blow up, and, you know, there are sequels and they blow up. Although, again, we got, you know, Super Mario Brothers 2 in the Western world is a game that wasn't even a Mario game. He was plastered over it, and the other characters, you know, again, sort of proving his kind of versatility. But, you know, so subsequently, once everything does blow up, like, he inevitably did get more of an identity, and especially when they started doing a voice, that was a big thing. And then, you know, you get into some other kind of times where Nintendo was struggling a bit in terms of, you know, commercially. Think of the GameCube era, and they start kind of just like put Mario as far, like Mario's this bankable thing that we've got, put him in everything, put him in SSX, put him in NBA Street or whatever it was. Mario Strikers, we talked about this before, like in connection with the wrestling question and Next Level and stuff. Like, it was not really in the regular Mario identity. It was much more like, oh, we've given him attitude, and, you know, we've kind of, this is a different take on it. More of a, he's angry now, you know, well, all this kind of
it's
stuff.
American Mario.
Yeah, man, like, you, I don't know, I feel like maybe like this idea that Mario stays Mario is a little bit overstated in the letter. Like, when I look at Super Mario Kart, back then, like, the big thing to me that made it Mario was that, well, it's the same levels as Super Mario World, or it's themed after the, you know, Super Mario World. You've got the Bowser Castle, you've got the haunted house, and that was kind of enough.
The chocolate world, and
yeah,
all
absolutely.
Other places.
And but I feel like you'd be hard pressed to, I don't know, it would be hard to make the argument that the shell, other than the fact that it's just an aesthetic thing. Like, the shell does not really, I don't know, like, it doesn't operate the same way. Like, yeah, sure, like, you throw it forward, it hits something, it's a weapon, but I think it's a stretch to say that, oh, well, it's basically the same function as in the Mario platformers. But like, you look at Super Mario 64 and it becomes a surfboard, you know? Like, it's not...
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, it's consistency across games.
Well, Mario 64, as we mentioned many times, is kind of a really odd kind of interpretation of Mario. You know, he punches and kicks things. Like, that's not a Mario thing at all, but he did it then. You know?
They're
like,
playing with ideas because they're dealing with 3D. I would argue
it was more than a Mario game. It was Nintendo attempts to quote unquote invent 3D gaming game.
Right.
So that's some of the reason why it is the way it is.
I would say that the shells is an example. It's relatively minor, but I think it actually works.
Well, it's probably the weakest example I could have picked, but the red shells are homing. Where does that come from?
The red Koopa Troopers behave slightly differently, though, because they don't walk off ledges. So it's like,
right, they're the smart ones.
Extrapolation of that.
Yeah, so that's actually what I was going to say. It's not a one to one reference because it wouldn't map one to one. But it's an adaptation that keeps a consistency.
I still feel like it's a stretch. Like there's no platforming, you know.
It's not a platforming game.
Super Mario Kart had like the feather, and you know the actual like, hopping was.
Which
more
should have given you a cape.
It did give you verticality though.
I would say that to his point, like there is a remarkable amount of thought put into how do we adapt elements from our other parts of the franchise into this completely separate game. I would say the fact that the shells work differently based on red versus green. Yeah, it's not an immediate one-to-one, but they took the time to do the effort. Like that to me, that's more important than does it behave exactly the same way? Because you couldn't map that behavior because you don't have Koopa Troopas just walking around.
Yeah, I guess maybe I'm not making my point very well, but I feel like the Mario identity comes from in Super Mario Kart comes more from the fact that they use sprites that are Mario sprites than any kind of intrinsic. You know, qualities of the game.
Well, like I said, it's not. I think the biggest strength that Mario's had there is not being overly defined, and then that makes him more sort of pliable, you know, more applicable to all these other kind of settings. But I will say, you know, when they got past the difficult times of GameCube. Obviously, difficult times in general were not behind them, but you know, Wii and DS doing really well. It seemed like they rode back a bit on, okay, we're not so desperate now. We don't need to kind of, you know, apportion Mario to like all these different things to like get third parties to like put games on our system or to create like, you know, software. You know, to have like a holiday game. Like, I think the original Mario Strikers was kind of like GameCube's Ultra Smash. I mean, it was better, I think, as a game, but you know what I mean? Like, it was like, oh, well, we don't really have a holiday title here for a GameCube. What should we do? Mario Sports, you know, like, once that stops being a problem, then it's like, okay, well, we can rein it in. And, you know, even with some of the difficulties they've had since, like the aforementioned Wii U era, although I said that did kind of, I think that was
that
the
led
genesis
to Mario
of
having
them.
A gun indirectly, you know.
I mean, you know he packs.
It's they now
Lave, John.
It's really quite tight in terms of you don't get that many different like treatments of the character. I mean, you got Paper Mario, I guess, but you know.
But I would say you've got a consistent Paper Mario now.
Well, yeah, that is almost just something unto itself. Isn't
I'd say consistently generic is Mario, right?
Yeah, he's
consistently
point is that he's,
well, and I think generic. Of, like compare him to Sonic, right? Like with Sonic. Right from the start, pitched as like, oh, he's a snarky kind of badass. So that instantly kind of locks him out, maybe not locks him out of certain things, but kind of typecasts him as a certain role, which makes him probably not as easy to insert into certain games or game types as Mario
they
is.
Did bloody try, didn't they? I mean, Sega, they had this thing and they were going to, you know, do all that. And I think the sort of failure of Sonic Extreme, aforementioned, to materialize gave us like, oh, well, how about Sonic 3D Blast on the Genesis? Like, you know, when you have a character like this, you know, it becomes this kind of fallback option in tough times, you know, and then when things are a bit better, okay, well, you know, we have this thing of value, and like there's a feeling that if you overextend it, you are risking it a bit. So if there's no need to risk that overextension and that dilution of the character, then you kind of, you don't. And certainly I think Nintendo have done that somewhat since, and it's just in terms of like, his look now is just so like New Super Mario Brothers Plastic Mario, like that is him. Like,
I mean, there is the literal perfect Mario reference model.
Yeah, exactly, and it's much more tight now in terms of there was a time when, you know, and this applies to more than just Mario, like, you know, Smash Brothers, like the characters kind of had their own interpretation instead of just like, but now it's, you know, everything toy-ish. Just looks really on model very literal sense.
And the thing is, like, that's a consistent thing for franchises that are things like Disney. Like, the being on model is incredibly important to them, and it's a big deal. They will deviate from the model for effect, and Nintendo will do that with Mario for effect. That's Paper Mario, but they've even come up with a standard deviation for Mario. Like, this is the appropriate two-dimensional Mario deviation. This is how you will produce that Mario. That's part of what made Mario Odyssey so fun. It's still he is kept to the visual standard, but they do all kinds of weird stuff with costumes and things to kind of build upon it. But I think also there's a consistent humor standard. How humor in the Mario games is written, and I know this is going to sound really weird, is very consistent. And that's the reason why Mario and Rabbids feels a little bit off brand, because A, the Rabbids are awful. But B, the humor is not the standard Nintendo Mario humor. And Mario games can be quite funny. There's a lot of really funny things in Odyssey. But the humor is soft, I guess is the way of putting it. Like, you're not being confronted with jokes. You're being given, like, just kind of funny visuals, silly, slapstick, that kind of stuff.
Oh, yeah, like Mario's cap on a T-Rex.
Yeah, exactly. It's not...
What I think of is the end with him and Bowser, like, commiserating. Like, that's pretty much the platonic ideal of Mario humor. It's
right.
Just, you know, it's just like an image, and it just says it all, you know. It's like silent comedy, and it's not, like, too, like, out there.
No, it's cartoony but soft. Like I'll give some examples. Even in, like, Mario Party games, there's you see those same kinds of layered out, like, visual gags that are really soft. But the big one, the one that took off a number of years ago now, is in Mario Kart 8. That slow mo of when you pass somebody and they make a face at you as they go past.
Yeah.
Like, it's such a little thing, but it's all consistent with how the franchise does its humor, how its characters act around one another, how they look. Like, the grimace face of Luigi as you pass him there is a model design for how Luigi should grimace. And these characters have evolved over time. And, like, we've talked about Luigi, how he always is, you know, kind of the scaredy cat archetype. And they've really built that character out over time. And the thing I think that gives them that consistency is that everything is being controlled about Mario outside of, or rather inside Kyoto. Like, anything that's going to touch Mario has got to at least go through the hands of somebody at the NCL office to be signed off on. And that's obviously not the case with Sonic. And you can, I mean, there's probably a sign-off process. Like, you couldn't just go make a Sonic movie and, like, buy the license and then tell Sega, well, you'll see it when you see it.
Well, they got to make sure it's extra shitty, so.
But the whole farce of what the character looked like in the recent Hollywood film. And,
that would never happen with Nintendo.
The approvals process there is somewhat at fault. But, you know, I mean, look, I don't know, maybe it was just one of these things in terms of just getting the deal done. It was easier if they pledged not to be, you know, kind of just looking over the filmmaker's shoulders the whole time.
That's a recipe for disaster.
Yeah, there are problems with that. And then, you know, look, it's they redesigned, they redid the effects. They, you know, it seemed like it kind of turned out okay. And I've not seen the film, but, you know, just in terms of the business,
much better.
It did. But, you know, it's an embarrassment. For Sega, for the brand, even though it's, like, not directly their fault or anything, it is still definitely the sort of thing that I can only imagine people at Nintendo live in mortal terror of.
Oh, yeah.
It does seem like, especially after the Bob Hoskins movie of the 90s, that the fear of embarrassment is, like, the most driving factor in there. Even more so than the drive to make money. Like, yes. You know, they have, look, I'm not saying Mario hasn't been in a load of shit and on a lot of merchandise, because of course he has. And I mean, they've milked it. But could they have milked it more before now? Good God.
Absolutely.
Yes. And they haven't because, like I said, I think there's a fear of, you know, killing the golden goose if you overdo it. That's part of it. But also just of blowback, you know, of embarrassment. I do think that is a powerful motivator with Nintendo. So it does get somewhat reined in. I think that's one of the things that makes Rabbids quite extraordinary. Like, that is really weird that happened.
Yeah.
It was mostly successful, I guess. And, you know, I can only imagine it did require a lot of coordination, you know, with Nintendo.
Yeah, I think the telling thing is how Nintendo was doing their toy licenses for Mario. It was very explicitly the license is with Jack Specific. Like, they Jack Specific is making the Mario toys, and the question is, why would you not like license them out more broadly? And the answer is because we are managing a relationship. And that makes it very easy to set up an approvals process and make sure things are being done the right way, and that the brand is being protected. This is I think the third or fourth North American production of a Sonic series done by a different organization, and so there isn't necessarily the same direct line of communication that's there, or it's being reestablished consistently. I think the fact we haven't seen a Mario TV series since the cartoon is telling. And the cartoon is actually not terribly far off from the comic books that Nintendo had a hand in producing. And the art of the cartoon isn't that terribly far off from the art that was in the instruction books. It's cheaper because it was being produced by Deke. And like, their entire philosophy is, let's spend as little money as we possibly can at any given moment. Like, it's just spend nothing.
To produce glorified commercials.
Right, exactly. So there's that. The other thing that I think is interesting, though, is this doesn't apply to other franchises as much. Now, Mario is their mascot. It's their Mickey. They're going to be more protective of it. Pokemon Company is less consistent in how things are depicted. Of course, that's run by a company that's only job is to manage the brand. So there's, I would say Pokemon almost lives outside this conversation. But, you know, there was the whole Legend of Zelda stuff. Link is consistently depicted in new and weird ways. There's no attempt to create like a brand standard Link. There sort of is one, kind of somewhere in the Twilight Princess Ocarina of Time space, but not really.
And they're so often quite happy to have like products overlapping, you know, where like Link is, you know, a game will come out and it's, you know, like you said, something in the vein of, you know, Twilight Princess, Ocarina of Time, Color Link, but then you'll get a game. There have been several games with Wind Waker style Link in it, and then, you know, you get to, obviously, on Switch, you've got Breath of the Wild Link, but then you've got little ceramic toy Link's Awakening Link. Like, it all just coexisting. I mean, it's and then to the point that, you know, you get separate characters in Smash Brothers,
right?
Because they're that different.
Or you get games like the first Hyrule Warriors, where there is Toon Link running around next to Bone Standard Link, next to Custom Blue Scarf Link. It's like we've, you know, they play with it more. And in fact, there was that Netflix series that ultimately didn't get made. There was a rumor about that today that it got canned because Nintendo was pissed. Netflix leaked it before the ink was dry on the deal.
And again, that kind of suggests that fear of like embarrassment, almost, you know what I mean? Like, it's not even just like wanting total control, it's wanting to be seen to have total control. So it's like, if there's leaks, if there's anything that suggests like, oh, you know, like this is, they haven't got a tight grip on this, we'll walk away from the whole thing then. Like,
right. And they did. They just peaced out. And like, there is the fact that, and we talked about at the start, you know, when they're talking about Super Nintendo World, all they tell us is that Miyamoto was bouncing between Orlando and Osaka and, you know, just to try to make sure this thing is being done absolutely perfectly. This has been his only focus. And when they talk about the movie, they say he has been in touch with the production company nonstop. This is his only focus because he has two only focuses right now. But ultimately,
which of course left Tezuka to deal with Lego Mario.
That's right. Yes, we had Lego Mario, which is actually somewhat off brand because, of course, it's Lego. But still, like, all the iconography is there, all the sound. Like, I don't actually
still,
sound.
It's still, yeah, like you said, it is off brand, but at the same time, it's still the hand feels like it's been there. You know, so it's like, oh well, you know, we it's got to be a particular, like, kind of play that differentiates it somewhat.
The sound font, actually, because the thing, one of the things it does is it makes a lot of noise. Beyond Martinet's voice, who, look, when Martinet finally moves on, there's going to be so much Martinet in the can that that they might not need to find a new Mario voice. They will have infinite Martinet. So when the movie got announced, people were like, I wonder if it will be Charles Martinet. Yes, it's going to be Charles Martinet voicing the character. It would be insane if it wasn't. Because Charles Martinet is not the voice of Mario in English-speaking territories. Charles Martinet is the voice of Mario, end of sentence. And so, yeah, like they have spent literally decades ensuring that he is the voice of Mario. And they trot him out at events to make Mario voice at people. Like it is their identity for that character. It's like the same reason that there's only ever one Mickey voice active at a time. Like, I am the voice of this character in all representations going forward. It's important to the brand as an icon. That doesn't really apply to Link because they don't really seem to care as much. Kirby, is their tabula rasa. Whatever we feel like doing with Kirby. He's clay today. He's made out of stitching. He's whatever. Doesn't matter. Yoshi's kind of the weird thing that gets to live outside that in the Mario universe. But even you know, Mario adjacent things like DK. DK's got to follow the brand standard. DK is going to wear that fucking tie until the heat death of the universe. It's going to happen. He's got one tie. He's going to wear it forever. Just if you hate DK's tie, I regret to inform you, it's never going away.
It's who he is. He's a single tie and he's buck naked. Forever.
Yeah, exactly. He's John Lindemann.
It's too close to home.
John's is waterproof for tub time.
That's true. I mean, we don't know DK's isn't. I mean, he eats a lot of bananas. It's probably at least Scotch guarded.
You know, so he spends all that time underwater just so we can enjoy the beautiful and music. So it should be
cosplay ideas all over the place here.
Oh God. But, you know, I think things like sound being consistent from game to game, like those Mario sound effects have been worn the fuck out. The music, there's a consistency in musical themes and all of this stuff. Like, it all comes together. Look, we already know what Mario in the Mario movie is going to look like, roughly. Like I said, there is perfect Mario. It was a great mystery what Sonic and the Sonic movie was going to look like. And to your point, when we saw it, everybody went, oh, dear God. And so they delayed the movie and did it again. And it has a very distinct look.
Yeah, it's still not exactly. Although Sonic itself in design has varied more over the years. You know, originally, it was just Felix the Cat sort of defaced. And he was kind of cute and chubby. And then later on, you know, he got tuned up and made more kind of.
He got poochied.
Even though it was, you know, quite a few years after, like, that had been satirized in the poochie episode. They were a bit late to the party with the poochification of Sonic. And so he got, like, somewhat longer limbed in that. And then Sonic Boom's, like, what if he had longer legs again? Like,
and bandages and all his appendages.
Yeah. So, it's not been as consistent over the years.
No. But John actually touched on something where, like, if the attitude, I don't think the attitude's been a big part of Sonic lately, but it invariably created a character that has to evolve.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, how much, I've not really seen, like, the Sonic cartoons from back in the day, or certainly
they're terrible.
But I mean, I wonder how much of the sort of perceived attitude of Sonic was actually Sonic, or the way they marketed the game, because those are separate things. But
it's the way they marketed the game. In the game, there's not that much there, really.
He's just saving like cute, helpless animals. Like, it's not like the big. He's not flipping people off or whatever.
Hold on. Right. They say he's saving them, but what if they liked being in the? I want a mech suit.
Right.
He's breaking their mech suit. He's a fucking asshole, is what he is.
I mean, Sega had to position themselves as the anti-Nintendo. So
yeah, so that was the American and European marketing of, although they could be more direct in America because there's less, you know, kind of regulations of that kind of
he tapped his foot,
but yeah, I mean, there was a certain amount of it in the wags his finger in your face.
Yeah, but still, like, it was a construct of the marketing in those cartoons.
I think it definitely kind of embellished that. There's a little bit of it in the character itself, but then it's like, oh, you know, Mario's slow, Mario's stupid, Nintendo's for babies, this is the badass. Like, and it was about the system, it was just a sales pitch. It wasn't, I don't think, you know, when they adapted Felix the Cat's design originally, they were thinking, oh, this guy is a badass. Although
they had to create like a doppelganger that was, you know, a darker version.
Yeah, they've had like Knuckles and then Shadow. It's like multiple times, and it's like we need the more.
Whereas Mario version. Mario's the one who got the gun, you know. Mm-hmm. So
right
again. Yep. You can't out-edge Nintendo, apparently.
I mean, I do want to point out those early cartoons, when they say Sonic was edgy in them, it would be like he would say, I got you now, dork Botnik. And
also,
then he liked
spicy food or something, which is, I mean, that is so edgy. That is.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Oof. I mean, chili dogs are the edgiest of food. Didn't you know that?
I remember reading like a history of when they were trying to design it, and at some point, like, he had like a female sidekick or something that was just literally straight up called Madonna because she was at the apex of her popularity at the time. Like, I mean, they were flailing a bit to just like, what's hip? This hip you speak of, how can we acquire it?
How do you do, fellow kids? Yeah, so there is a certain amount of, like, it ends up having to evolve consistently just to accommodate that, and you end up running into a character that is invariably going to be less consistent as a consequence, and here we are. I think though you nailed it when you said that Nintendo is obsessive with control, and Mario being bone standard Mario is important to that control. When we do get the first media property using the Legend of Zelda franchise, I'll be very curious what they allow. I thought the live action one was a terrible idea for a number of reasons. But if
it's just how many times can you listen to a man go scrah or whatever? It's, you know, I mean, that's you can't do 13 episodes of prestige television for like 5 years just on the basis of that.
I bet you can. You could just keep going. Just you know, just keep it going. No talking. But it I would be curious what iteration of the franchise that used. We've seen in Pokemon, they're much more willing to do stuff again because it's being controlled by that middle tier brand. I mean, the Pokemon movie is a huge divorce tonally and visually.
Oh, Detective Pikachu.
Yeah, like all of that stuff is a giant step from where they are normally. And it seemed to have been reasonably successful for them, but it was very much a deviation. It was sort of a deconstruction of that franchise. They would never do that with Mario. Even if the movie hadn't happened, I think the movie was more a lesson in don't let other people make decisions than it was, don't be weird. It was more don't be out of the loop. That movie happened to Nintendo. They weren't an active participant. and we will never see that again with Mario. I don't think they would let that happen with any of their franchises. It's just in Mario's the one that's going to get licensed first and foremost because it is the icon. And it's the one that they are the most conservative with. Again, because it's their icon. It's their singular representation. And Mario evolves, like the perfect Mario as it is. Mario does evolve, and if you go look at Mario from 10 years ago and now, you'll see there's been some minor revisions along the edge. That will continue to happen, but it's going to be slow evolution. We're not going to see just wild swings in the Mario, which you may or may not choose to do. That is going to do it for email this week. You know, we had a relatively limited email section. So emails go to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. You can also send us your suggestions for retroactive ideas. That may be like categories of games you think we should try or specific titles. But these are suggestions. We are not beholden to them. We will not surrender to the monsters. So you can send those to us again. That is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. Lastly, we have a new episode of the RFN Patreon, the Nintendo World Report Patreon, RFN exclusive out. John, what did we do?
For the Patreon?
Yes.
Let's see. We talked about Ace Attorney.
We did. The Ace Attorney live action film that came out in Japan a while ago now.
Yeah, 2012.
Yeah.
So we all watched it and we gave our thoughts on it. And for the first time in one of these RFN movie clubs, it's not as long as the movie. Go us. So you can get that at for $1 a month, as well as 19 other RFN Patreon episodes at patreon.com/NWR. And on that, it's time for us to go. Greg, what is our music for this week?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, I do want to mention Radio Trivia Podcast Edition is back for 2021. Yes. Johnny's on it. But obviously can't really say much of anything about the games covered because that is the whole point. You have to guess them. But good lineup, a good sort of range of, you know, kind of obscure and mainstream of you know, retro and in some cases very recent, but and a lot of sort of long developing tracks. So go interesting places. Good stuff. Should definitely check that out. And so, yeah, to the closing music for today. Now, this is a game that Guillaume spoke about, I think, two episodes ago. This is Moon. The anti-RPG, or however it's supposed to. Yeah, so I've been sitting on this one. I think it was last September that Spencer sent this in. I'm waiting for a talk because he said it expressly at that time that James and Guy in particular need to play this. So it kind of was filed away into pull out when appropriate. And then, of course, I think we did Paradise Killer that week. So, yeah, these things happen. But you still wanted to do this now because, it's a pretty cool song. So this is actually there were two that were offered by Spencer. I'm going with 226 46th Street Moon Disc version. So this has got a kind of end of a TV show kind of vibe to it because of the sax. So, you know, perfect. I've got a soft spot for Baby Bird. I'm a simple man. Give me the sax and I will put it at the end.
Great. All right. Well, on that, bye, everybody.
Bye.
Later.
Bye-bye.